foods, plant-based, WFPB, diet. Since publication of the first edition of this book, many more trials testing the effects of the WFPB diet on diabetics have been conducted. Perhaps the most impressive finding since this book's first edition is the peer-reviewed report of Dr. Neil Barnard and his colleagues. In a 74-week study, relatively long compared to the usual 2 to 3 month studies, subjects on a vegan diet fared better than subjects on the diet recommended by the American Diabetes Association, ADA, with some of the differences in response being statistically significant. What made this finding even more impressive was the fact that participants following the vegan diet did not adhere fully to a strict whole food, plant-based diet, and so their diet was not as nutritionally potent as it could have been. See Figure 7.4. The dietary changes achieved in this real-world trial, factoring in challenges of patient compliance, approach but do not reach the nutrient composition of the WFPB diet. Dietary fat is higher, 22.3% versus approximately 10%. Dietary protein is higher, 14.8% versus approximately 10%. And dietary carbohydrates are lower, 66.3% versus approximately 80%. Total fiber consumption, 30 grams per day, is substantially lower than the 50-plus possible in the WFPB diet, as indicated by intakes in China, as high as 77 grams per day. Also, the participants in the vegan group were consuming a small amount of animal-based foods, as indicated by the recorded cholesterol consumption. Plant-based foods have no cholesterol. Given these differences, and based on other clinicians' experiences and previous research, I suspect the benefits would have been larger had there been greater dietary change. For example, a 1976 study demonstrated that a high 75% complex, that is, whole food, carbohydrate diet allowed 9 of 13 diabetic men to completely discontinue, and 2 more to have, the insulin medications they previously needed when eating a 43% complex carbohydrate ADA diet. It's also worth noting that the ADA diet in this study was near the margin of the ADA recommendations, low in plant-based carbohydrates and dietary fiber, and high in protein and fat, with high consumption of animal-based cholesterol. If this is how type 2 diabetics interpret ADA guidelines, it is clear that no resolution of disease is possible beyond the peripheral management of symptoms through pills and procedures. The diet of the vegan type 2 diabetics was better than that of the ADA type 2 diabetics, yet still a far cry from the diet shown in earlier research, offered in controlled settings, to have such a very rapid, remarkably profound effect in treating and resolving this disease. The vegan diet is going in the right direction, just not nearly fast enough. And in the meantime, we've spent more than $250 billion, as of 2012, pretending to treat a disease, the fourth leading cause of death, that already has a cure. The persistence of habit. As you can see from these findings, we can beat diabetes. Two studies in the early 2000s considered a combination of diet and exercise effects on this disease. One study placed 3,234 non-diabetic people at risk for diabetes, elevated blood sugar, into three different groups. One group, the control, received standard dietary information and a drug placebo. No effect. One received the standard dietary information and the drug metformin. And the third group received intensive lifestyle intervention, which included a moderately low-fat diet and an exercise plan to lose at least 7% of their weight. After almost 3 years, the lifestyle group had 58% fewer cases of diabetes than the control group. The The drug group reduced the number of cases only by 31%. Compared to the control, both treatments worked, but clearly a lifestyle change is much safer and more powerful than simply taking a drug. Moreover, the lifestyle change would be effective in solving other health problems, whereas the drug would not. The second study also found that the rate of diabetes could be reduced by 58% just by modest lifestyle changes, including exercise, weight loss, and a moderately low-fat diet. Imagine what would happen if people fully adopted the healthiest diet, a whole foods, plant-based diet. I strongly suspect that virtually all type 2 diabetes cases could be prevented. Unfortunately, misinformation and ingrained habits are wreaking havoc on our health. Our habit of eating hot dogs, hamburgers, and French fries is killing us. Even Dr. James Anderson, who achieved profound results with many patients by prescribing a near-vegetarian diet, is not immune to habitual health advice. He writes, "Ideally, diets providing 70% of calories as carbohydrate and up to 70 grams of fiber daily offer the greatest health benefits for individuals with diabetes. However, these diets allow only 1 to 2 ounces of meat daily and are impractical for home use for many individuals." Why does Professor Anderson, a very fine researcher, say that such a diet is impractical and thereby prejudices listeners before they even consider the evidence? Yes, changing your lifestyle may seem impractical. It may seem impractical to give up meat and high-fat foods. But I wonder how practical it is to be 350 pounds and have type 2 diabetes at the age of 15, like the girl mentioned at the start of this chapter. I wonder how practical it is to have a lifelong condition that can't be cured by drugs or surgery, a condition that often leads to heart disease, stroke, blindness, or amputation, a condition that might require you to inject insulin into your body every day for the rest of your life. Radically changing our diets may be impractical, but it might also be worth it. Chapter 8. Common cancers: breast, prostate, large bowel, colon, and rectal. Much of my career concentrated on the study of cancer. My laboratory work focused on several cancers, including those of the liver, breast, and pancreas, and some of the most impressive data from China were related to cancer. For this lifetime work, the American Institute for Cancer Research kindly presented me with their Research Achievement Award in 1998. An exceptional number of books have summarized the evidence on the effects of nutrition on a variety of cancers, each with their own particularities. But what I've found is that the nutritional effects on the cancers I've chosen to discuss here are virtually the same for all cancers, regardless of whether they are initiated by different factors or are located in different parts of the body. Using this principle, I can limit my discussion to three cancers, which will allow me space in the rest of the book to address diseases other than cancer, and to demonstrate the breadth of evidence linking food to many health concerns. I have chosen to comment on three cancers that affect hundreds of thousands of Americans and that generally represent other cancers as well: two reproductive cancers that get plenty of attention, breast and prostate, and one digestive cancer, large bowel, the second leading cause of cancer death behind lung cancer. Breast cancer. It was spring about 20 years ago. I was in my office at Cornell when I was told that a woman with a question regarding breast cancer was on the phone. "I have a strong history of breast cancer in my family," the woman, Betty, said. "My mother and grandmother both died from the disease, and my 45-year-old sister was recently diagnosed with it. Given this family problem, I can't help but be afraid for my 9-year-old daughter. She's going to start menstruating soon, and I worry about her risks of getting breast cancer." Her fear was evident in her voice. "I've seen a lot of research showing that family history is important, and I'm afraid that it's inevitable that my daughter will get breast cancer. One of the options I've been thinking about is a mastectomy for my daughter to remove both breasts. Do you have any advice?" This woman was in an exceptionally difficult position. Does she let her daughter grow up into a death trap or grow up without breasts? Although extreme, this question represents a variety of similar questions faced every day by thousands of women around the world. These questions were especially encouraged by the early reports on the discovery of the breast cancer gene, BRCA1. Headline articles in the New York Times and other newspapers and magazines trumpeted this discovery as an enormous advance. The hoopla surrounding BRCA1, which now also includes BRCA2, reinforced the idea that breast cancer was due to genetic misfortune. This caused great fear among people with a family history of breast cancer. It also generated excitement among scientists and pharmaceutical companies. The possibility was high that new technologies would be able to assess overall breast cancer risk in women by doing genetic testing. They hoped they might be able to manipulate this new gene in a way that would prevent or treat breast cancer. Journalists busily started translating selective bits of this information for the public, relying heavily on the fatalistic genetic attitude. No doubt this contributed to the concern of mothers like Betty. "Well, let me first tell you that I am not a physician," I said. "I can't help you with diagnosis or treatment advice. That's for your physician to do. I can speak about the current research in a more general way, however, if that is of any help to you." "Yes," she said. "That's what I wanted." I told her a little bit about the China study and about the important role of nutrition. I told her that just because a person has the gene for a disease does not mean that they are destined to get cancer. Prominent studies reported that only a tiny minority of cancers can be solely blamed on genes. I was surprised at how little she knew about nutrition. She thought genetics was the only factor that determined risk. She didn't realize that food was an important factor in breast cancer as well. We talked for 20 or 30 minutes, a brief time for such an important matter. By the end of the conversation, I had the feeling that she was not satisfied with what I told her. Perhaps it was my conservative, scientific way of talking, or my reluctance to give her a recommendation. Maybe, I thought, she had already made up her mind to do the procedure. She thanked me for my time, and I wished her well. I remember thinking about how often I receive questions from people about specific health situations, and that this was one of the most unusual. But Betty wasn't alone. One other woman also talked to me regarding the possibility of her young daughter undergoing surgery to remove both breasts. Other women who already had one breast removed wondered whether to have the second breast removed as a preventive measure. It's clear that breast cancer is an important concern in our society. 1 out of 8 American women will be diagnosed with this disease during their lifetimes, one of the highest rates in the world. Grassroots breast cancer organizations are widespread, strong, relatively well-funded, and exceptionally active compared to other health activist organizations. This disease, perhaps more than any other, incites panic and fear in many women. When I think back to that conversation I had with Betty, I now feel that I could have made a stronger statement about the role nutrition plays in breast cancer. I still would not have been able to give her clinical advice, but the information I now know might have been of more use to her. So, what would I tell her now? Risk factors. There are at least 4 important breast cancer risk factors that are affected by nutrition, as shown in Chart 8.1. Many of these relationships were confirmed in the China study after being well established in other research. With the exception of blood cholesterol, these risk factors are variations on the same theme: exposure to excess amounts of female hormones, including estrogen and progesterone, increases breast cancer risk. Women who consume a diet rich in animal-based foods with a reduced amount of whole plant-based foods reach puberty earlier and menopause later, thus extending their reproductive lives. They also have higher levels of female hormones throughout their lifespan, as shown in Chart 8.2. According to our China study data, lifetime exposure to estrogen is at least 2.5 to 3.0 times higher among Western women when compared with rural Chinese women. This is a huge difference for such a critically important hormone. To use the words of one of the leading breast cancer research groups in the world, there is overwhelming evidence that estrogen levels are a critical determinant of breast cancer risk. Estrogen directly participates in the cancer process. It also tends to indicate the presence of other female hormones that play a role in breast cancer risk. Increased levels of estrogen and related hormones result from consuming typical Western diets high in fat and animal protein and low in dietary fiber. The difference in estrogen levels between rural Chinese women and Western women is all the more remarkable because a previous report found that a mere 17% decrease in estrogen levels could account for a huge difference in breast cancer rates when comparing different countries. Imagine, then, what 26 to 63% lower blood estrogen levels and 8 to 9 fewer reproductive years of blood estrogen exposure could mean, as we found in the China study. This idea that breast cancer is centered on estrogen exposure is profound because diet plays a major role in establishing estrogen exposure. This suggests that the risk of breast cancer is preventable if we eat foods that will keep estrogen levels under control. The sad truth is that most women simply are not aware of this evidence. If this information were properly reported by responsible and credible public health agencies, I suspect that many more young women might be taking very real, very effective steps to avoid this awful disease. The common issues. Genes. Understandably, women who are most afraid of this disease have a family history of breast cancer. Family history implies that genes do play a role in the development of breast cancer. But I hear too many people say, in effect, that it's all in the family, and deny that they can do anything to help themselves. This fatalistic attitude removes a sense of personal responsibility for one's own health and profoundly limits available options. It is true that if you have a family history of breast cancer, you are at an increased risk of getting the disease. However, one research group found that less than 3% of all breast cancer cases can be attributed to family history. Even though other groups have estimated that a higher percentage of cases are due to family history or genes, the vast majority of breast cancer in American women is not due to these factors. But genetic fatalism continues to define the nation's mindset. Among the genes that influence breast cancer risk, BRCA1 and BRCA2 have received the most attention since their discovery in 1994. These genes, when mutated, confer a higher risk both for breast and ovarian cancers. These mutated genes may be passed on from generation to generation. That is, they are inherited. In the excitement over these discoveries, however, other information has been ignored. First, only 0.2% of individuals in the general population, 1 in 500, carry the mutated forms of these genes. Because of the rarity of these genetic aberrations, only a few percent of the breast cancer cases in the general population can be attributed to mutated BRCA1 or BRCA2 genes. Second, these genes are not the only genes that participate in the development of this disease. Many more will surely be discovered. Third, the mere presence of BRCA1, BRCA2, or any other breast cancer gene does not guarantee disease occurrence. Environmental and dietary factors play a central role in determining whether these genes are expressed. A later paper reviewed 22 studies that assessed the risk of breast and ovarian cancer among women who carried mutated BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. Overall, disease risk was 65% for breast cancer and 39% for ovarian cancer by age 70 for BRCA1 women, and 45% and 11% respectively for BRCA2 women. Women with these genes certainly face high risks for breast cancer. But even among these high-risk women, there is still good reason to believe that more attention to diet is likely to pay handsome rewards. About half of the women who carry these rare, potent genes do not get breast cancer. In short, although the discovery of BRCA1 and BRCA2 added an important dimension to the breast cancer story, the excessive emphasis given to these particular genes and genetic causation in general is not warranted. I do not mean to diminish the importance of knowing all there is to know about these genes for the small minority of women who carry them. But we need to remind ourselves that these genes need to be expressed in order for them to participate in disease formation, and nutrition may control this. We've already seen in Chapter 3 how a diet high in animal-based protein alters genetic expression. Screening and non-nutritional prevention. With all of this new information regarding genetic risk and family history, women are often encouraged to get screened for breast cancer. Screening is a reasonable step, especially for women who may have tested positive for the BRCA genes. But it's important to remember that doing a mammography or getting a genetic test to see if you harbor BRCA genes does not constitute prevention of breast cancer. Screening is merely an observation to see whether the disease has progressed to an observable state. Some studies have found that groups of women who undergo frequent mammography have slightly lower mortality rates than groups of women who do not undergo frequent mammography. This implies that our cancer treatments are more likely to be successful if the cancer is found at an earlier stage. This is likely to be true, but there is some concern over the way statistics are used in this debate. One of the statistics used to support early detection and the ensuing treatments is that once women are diagnosed with breast cancer, their likelihood of surviving for at least 5 years is higher than ever before. What this really means is that with the aggressive campaign for regular screening, many women are discovering their breast cancer at an earlier stage of disease. When disease is discovered at an earlier stage, it is less likely to lead to death within 5 years, regardless of treatment. As a consequence, we may have an improved 5-year survival rate simply because women find out that they have breast cancer earlier in the disease progression, not because our treatments have improved over time. Beyond the current screening methods, there are other non-nutritional options for prevention that have been promoted. They are especially of interest to women who have a high risk of breast cancer due to family history and/or the presence of the BRCA genes. These options include taking a drug such as tamoxifen and/or mastectomy. Tamoxifen is one of the most popular drugs taken to prevent breast cancer. But the long-term benefits of this option are not clear. One major U.S. study showed that tamoxifen administered over a period of 4 years to women at increased risk of breast cancer reduced the number of cases by an impressive 49%. This benefit, however, may be limited to women whose estrogen levels are very high. It was this result that led the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to approve use of tamoxifen by women who met certain criteria. Other studies suggest that the enthusiasm for this drug is not warranted. Two less substantial European trials have failed to show any statistically significant tamoxifen benefit, raising some doubt about how dramatic the benefit really is. Moreover, there is the additional concern that tamoxifen raises the risks for stroke, uterine cancer, cataracts, deep vein thrombosis, and pulmonary embolism, although the overall benefits of breast cancer prevention are still believed to outweigh the risks. Other chemicals have also been investigated as alternatives to tamoxifen, but these drugs are encumbered by limited effectiveness and/or some of the same troublesome side effects. Drugs such as tamoxifen and its newer analogs are considered anti-estrogen drugs. In effect, they work by reducing the activity of estrogen, which is known to be associated with elevated breast cancer risk. My question is quite simple. Why don't we ask why estrogen is so high in the first place, and once we recognize its nutritional origin, why don't we correct that cause? We now have enough information to show that a diet low in animal-based protein, low in fat, and high in whole plant foods will reduce estrogen levels. Instead of suggesting dietary change as a solution, we spend hundreds of millions of dollars developing and publicizing a drug that may or may not work and that almost certainly will have unintended side effects. The ability of dietary factors to control female hormone levels has long been known in the research community, but a more recent study was particularly impressive. Several female hormones, which increase with the onset of puberty, were lowered by 20-30%, even by 50% for progesterone, simply by having girls 8 to 10 years of age consume a diet modestly low in fat and animal-based food for 7 years. These results are extraordinary because they were obtained with a modest dietary change and were produced during a critical time of a young girl's life, when the first seeds of breast cancer were being sowed. These girls consumed a diet of no more than 28% fat and less than 150 milligrams of cholesterol per day, a moderate plant-based diet. I believe that had they consumed a diet devoid of animal-based foods, and had they started this diet earlier in life, they would have seen even greater benefits, including a delay in puberty and an even lower risk of breast cancer later in life. Women at high risk for breast cancer are given three options: watch and wait, take tamoxifen medication for the remainder of their lives, or undergo mastectomy. There should be a fourth option: consuming a diet free of animal-based foods, refined carbohydrates, and added fats, avoiding alcohol, which increases breast cancer risk, and enjoying abundant exercise, which significantly decreases risk, in addition to regular monitoring for those at high risk. I stand by the usefulness of this fourth option, even for women who have already had a first mastectomy. Using diet as an effective treatment of already diagnosed disease has been well documented in human studies with advanced heart disease, clinically documented type 2 diabetes, see chapter 7, early prostate cancer, advanced melanoma, a deadly skin cancer, and in experimental animal studies, liver cancer. Environmental chemicals. Another breast cancer conversation has been taking place for some years now and has been the subject of increasing interest in the years since the first edition of this book was published. It concerns environmental chemicals. These widely distributed chemicals have been shown to disrupt hormones, although it is not clear which hormones in humans are being disrupted. They may also cause reproductive abnormalities, birth defects, and type 2 diabetes. There are many different types of offending chemicals, most of which are commonly associated with industrial pollution. One group, including dioxins and PCBs, persist in the environment because they are not metabolized when consumed. Thus, they are not excreted from the body. Because of this lack of metabolism, these chemicals accumulate in the body fat and breast milk of lactating mothers. Some of these chemicals are known to promote the growth of cancer cells, although humans may not be at significant risk until one consumes excessive quantities of meat, milk, and fish. Indeed, 90-95% of our exposure to these chemicals comes from consuming animal products, yet another reason why consuming animal-based foods can be risky. A second group of these environmental chemicals is also commonly perceived to be a significant cause of breast and other cancers. They are called PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. and are found in auto exhaust, factory smokestacks, petroleum tar products, and tobacco smoke, among other processes common to an industrial society. Unlike PCBs and dioxins, when we consume PAHs in food and water, we can metabolize and excrete them. But there is a snag. When the PAHs are metabolized within the body, they produce intermediate products that react with DNA to form tightly bound complexes or adducts. See Chapter 3. This is the first step in causing cancer. In fact, these chemicals later were shown to adversely affect the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes of breast cancer cells grown in the laboratory. In Chapter 3, I described studies in my laboratory showing that when a very potent carcinogen is put into the body, the rate at which it causes problems is mostly controlled by nutrition. Thus, the rate at which PAHs are metabolized into products that bind to DNA is very much controlled by what we eat. Very simply, consuming a Western-type diet will increase the rate at which chemical carcinogens like PAHs bind to DNA to form products that cause cancer. So when a 2002 study found slightly increased levels of PAH DNA adducts in women with breast cancer in Long Island, New York, it may well have been that these women were consuming a more meaty diet, which increased the binding of the PAHs to DNA. It is entirely possible that the quantity of PAHs being consumed had nothing to do with increasing breast cancer risk. In fact, in this study, the number of PAH DNA adducts in these women seems to be unrelated to PAH exposure. How is this possible? Perhaps all of the women in this Long Island study consumed a relatively uniform, low level of PAHs, and the only ones who subsequently got breast cancer were the ones who ate a diet high in fat and animal protein, thus causing more of the ingested PAHs to bind to their DNA. In this same Long Island study, breast cancer was not associated with PCBs and dioxins, the chemicals that can't be metabolized. This and other findings suggest that environmental chemicals seem to play a far less significant role for breast cancer than the kind of foods we choose to eat. Many research reports on this topic have been published since the first edition of this book in 2005. But these reports almost uniformly assume that environmental chemicals are the main causal factors for breast cancer, leaving little or no role for nutrition, not even any discussion. At best, they make superficial references to associations of obesity or calorie intake with breast cancer, but even then leave unsaid what causes obesity or what is known about its relationship to calorie intake and expenditure. One of the most representative examples of this literature, and one that has been substantially referenced, is a Canadian case-control study in which 1,005 breast cancer cases and 1,146 community controls were surveyed for possible associations of breast cancer with occupations that involved environmental chemical exposure. Only 5 of 29 occupation categories, agriculture, bars, gambling, automotive plastics manufacturing, food canning, and metalworking, showed statistically significant associations with breast cancer risk, and 4 of those were barely significant. This strikes me as very weak evidence for an association of environmental chemicals with breast cancer. Nonetheless, these researchers still suggested that their findings support hypotheses linking breast cancer risk and exposures likely to include carcinogens and chemicals that disrupt endocrine hormone activities. While exposure to environmental chemicals based on occupation does appear to play some role in cancer development, blaming the relationship between diet and breast cancer on environmental chemicals in our food has long been used to avoid the far more important role of our food's nutrient composition. To judge which best explains the relationship of diet with breast cancer, consider the following 2 major studies. The first is a post-2005 review of 439 recent studies on breast cancer and environmental chemicals. Its authors correctly emphasized the enormous complexity of classes of chemicals thought to increase breast cancer risk. But then they failed to take into account a role for nutrition in breast cancer causation. As they say in the report's introduction, "We do not discuss the often complicated and inconclusive literature examining possible relationships between diet, stress, or obesity, and risk for breast cancer." A second major report concluded, after carefully reviewing the conclusions of an exhaustive collection of diet and breast cancer studies, that there is no association of diet with breast cancer incidence that is consistent, strong, and statistically significant, with exception of alcohol intake, overweight, and weight gain. But they also suggested, correctly, that this lack of effect may be due to the limited dietary variation typically seen in within-country studies when compared with the much greater dietary variation seen in between-country studies. Together, these reports would appear to favor environmental chemicals as a more likely explanation for the impressive diet association with breast cancer. But this preference is based on inferences, not empirical findings. In evaluating the nutritional explanation for diet's association with breast cancer, the summary reports draw on the insufficient dietary variation observed for in-country dietary studies, rather than the greater variation observed in between-country studies, a choice that reflects either a lack of author knowledge or a lack of sufficient experimental power to detect the nutrition effect likely to exist. Upon ingestion, environmental chemicals, like their pharmaceutical relatives, are detoxified, sometimes activated, by a major liver enzyme system called the mixed function oxidase. Nutrition can substantially and quickly modify this enzyme activity, a fact that I reviewed over 40 years ago. We showed that modest changes in dietary protein, for example, can greatly change the toxicity of a pesticide like heptachlor, a barbiturate like phenobarbital, and the carcinogenicity of even the most potent chemical carcinogens like aflatoxin. See Chapter 3. Each may be called an environmental chemical. The observed effects of environmental chemicals in these and other studies may primarily be an expression of nutrition's effect on disease outcomes, with or without environmental chemical intervention. The same is the case for observations related to the endocrine disruptor chemicals, which disrupt the activity of hormones like estrogen that affect a wide variety of biological systems. Breast cancer risk is encouraged with greater estrogen exposure, but convincing evidence shows that nutrition, especially dietary protein, fiber, and fat, can alter the estrogen levels in blood, thus producing estrogen disruptor-like activities. How much of these environmental chemical associations reported in the literature are due to chemical exposure per se, and how much to nutritional modifications of these effects? Is it possible that the five communities in the Canadian occupation study that showed an association of environmental chemicals with more breast cancer did so due to the consumption of less nutritious foods? When we scientists refrain from getting data on diet, we cannot know the answer. And I am left with the same conclusion I presented in the first edition of this book, that breast cancer is primarily caused by the same nutrition that elevates risk for other cancers, a diet lacking in whole, plant-based foods. I want to be abundantly clear. I vigorously oppose exposing ourselves to unnatural environmental chemicals, especially those with demonstrated toxicity, but a narrow focus on adverse effects of environmental chemicals should not be used to sidestep the really important way of reducing disease occurrence, a WFPB diet. Hormone replacement therapy. I must briefly mention one final breast cancer issue. whether to use hormone replacement therapy, HRT, which increases breast cancer risk. HRT is taken by many women to alleviate unpleasant effects of menopause, protect bone health, and prevent coronary heart disease. However, it is now becoming widely acknowledged that HRT is not as beneficial as once thought, and it may have certain severe side effects. So, what are the facts? I wrote this commentary for the first edition of this book at an opportune time, because the results of some large trials of HRT use had just been released in the previous year. Of special interest are two large randomized intervention trials, the Women's Health Initiative, WHI, and the Heart and Estrogen Progestin Replacement Study, HERS. Among women who take HRT, after 5.2 years, the WHI trial is showing a 26% increase in breast cancer cases, while the HERS study is seeing an even greater 30% increase. These studies are consistent. It appears that increased exposure to female hormones via HRT does indeed lead to more breast cancer. It has been thought that HRT is associated with lower rates of coronary heart disease. However, this is not necessarily true. In the large WHI trial, for every 10,000 healthy postmenopausal women who took HRT, there were 7 more women with heart disease, 8 more with strokes, and 8 more with pulmonary embolisms, the opposite of what had been expected. HRT may increase cardiovascular disease risk after all. On the other hand, HRT did have a beneficial effect on colorectal cancer and bone fracture rate. Among every 10,000 women, there were 6 fewer colorectal cancers and 5 fewer bone fractures. Since publication of the first edition, reports indicated that breast cancer incidence fell sharply by 6.7% in 2003, as compared with 2002, then leveled off in 2004. The size of this decline closely corresponded to the decline in HRT use over the same period, further supporting the earlier findings cited before that estrogen promotes breast cancer, as well as showing the rapidity of response when HRT exposure is terminated. So how do you make a decision with such information? Just by adding and subtracting the numbers, we can see that HRT may well be the cause of more harm than good. We can tell each individual woman to make her own decision depending on which disease and which unpleasant outcome or symptom she fears the most, as many physicians are likely to do. But this can be a tough decision for women who are having a difficult time with menopause. These women must choose between living unaided through the emotional and physical symptoms of menopause in order to preserve a low risk of breast cancer, or taking HRT to manage their menopause discomforts while increasing their risk of breast cancer and possibly cardiovascular disease. To say that this scenario troubles me would be an understatement. We have spent well over $1 billion on the research and development of these HRT medical preparations, and all we get is some apparent pluses and probably even more minuses. Calling this troubling doesn't begin to describe it. Instead of relying on HRT, I suggest that there is a better way, using food. The argument goes like this. During the reproductive years, hormone levels are elevated, although the levels among women who eat plant-based diets are not as elevated. When women reach the end of their reproductive years, it is entirely natural for reproductive hormones of all women to drop to a low base level. As reproductive years come to an end, the lower hormone levels among plant eaters don't crash as hard as they do among animal eaters. Using hypothetical numbers for circulating estrogen levels to illustrate the concept, the levels of plant eaters may crash from 40 to 15, rather than 60 to 15 for animal eaters. These abrupt hormone changes in the body are what cause menopausal symptoms. Therefore, a plant-based diet leads to a less severe hormone crash and a gentler menopause. This argument is eminently reasonable, based on what we know, although more studies are necessary. But even if future studies fail to confirm these details, a plant-based diet still offers the lowest risk for both breast cancer and heart disease for other reasons. It might just be the best of all worlds, something that no drug can offer. In each of the various issues involving breast cancer risk, tamoxifen use, HRT use, environmental chemical exposure, preventative mastectomy, I am convinced that these practices are distractions that prevent us from considering a safer and far more useful nutritional strategy. It is critical that we change the way we think about this disease, and that we provide this information to the women who need it. Large bowel cancer, including colon and rectum. At the end of June 2002, George W. Bush handed the presidency over to Dick Cheney for a period of roughly 2 hours while he underwent a colonoscopy. Because of the implications President Bush's colonoscopy had for world politics, the story made national news, and colon and rectal screening were briefly thrust into the spotlight. Across the country, whether the comedians were making jokes or the news anchors were describing the drama, everybody was suddenly, briefly, talking about this thing called a colonoscopy and what it was for. It was a rare moment in which the country turned its focus to some of the most prolific killer diseases, colon and rectal cancers. Because colon and rectal cancers are both cancers of the large bowel, and because of their other similarities, they often are grouped together under the term colorectal cancer. It is the fourth most common cancer worldwide in terms of overall mortality, and is the second most common in the United States, with 6% of Americans getting it during their lifetime. Some even claim that by age 70, one half of the population of westernized countries will develop a tumor in the large bowel, and 10% of these cases will progress to a malignancy. Geographic disparity. North America, Europe, Australia, and wealthier Asian countries, Japan, Singapore, have very high rates of colorectal cancer, while Africa, Asia, and most of Central and South America have very low rates. For example, the Czech Republic has a death rate of 34.19 per 100,000 males, while Bangladesh has a death rate of 0.63 per 100,000 males. Chart 8.3 shows a comparison of average death rates between more developed countries and less developed countries. All these rates are age-adjusted. The fact that rates of colorectal cancer vary hugely between countries has been known for decades. The question has always been why. Are the differences due to genetics or to environment? It seems that lifestyle factors, including diet, play the most important roles in colorectal cancer. Migrant studies have shown that as people move from a low cancer risk area to a high cancer risk area, they assume an increased risk within two generations. This suggests that diet and lifestyle are important causes of this cancer. Other studies have also found that rates of colorectal cancer change rapidly as a population's diet or lifestyle changes. These rapid changes in cancer rates within one population cannot possibly be explained by changes in inherited genes. In the context of human society, it takes thousands of years to get widespread, permanent changes in the inherited genes that are passed from one generation to the next. Clearly, something about environment or lifestyle is either preventing or enhancing the risk of getting colorectal cancer. In a landmark paper published almost 40 years ago, researchers compared environmental factors and cancer rates in 32 countries around the world. One of the strongest links between any cancer and any dietary factor was between colon cancer and meat intake. Chart 8.4 shows this link for women in 23 different countries. In this report, countries where more meat, more animal protein, more sugar, and fewer cereal grains were consumed had far higher rates of colon cancer. Another researcher whom I mentioned in Chapter 4, Dennis Burkett, hypothesized that intake of dietary fiber was essential for digestive health in general. He compared stool samples and fiber intakes in Africa and Europe, and proposed that colorectal cancers were largely the result of low fiber intake. Fiber, remember, is only found in plant foods. It is the part of the plant that our body cannot digest. Using data from another famous study that compared diets in 7 different countries, researchers found that eating an additional 10 grams of dietary fiber a day lowered the long-term risk of colon cancer by 33%. There are 10 grams of fiber in 1 cup of red raspberries, 1 Asian pear, or 1 cup of peas. A cup of just about any variety of bean would provide significantly more than 10 grams of fiber. From all this research, it seems clear that something can be said for the importance of diet in colorectal cancer. But what exactly stops colon and rectal cancer? Is it fiber? Is it fruits and vegetables? Is it carbohydrates? Is it milk? Each of these foods or nutrients has been suggested to play a role. The debate has raged, and solid answers are seldom agreed upon. The specific cure. Most of the debate over the past 35 years on dietary fiber and its link to large bowel cancer began with Burkett's work in Africa. Because of Burkett's prominence, many people have believed that fiber is the source of colorectal health. Perhaps you have already heard that fiber is good for preventing colon cancer. At least you probably have heard that fiber keeps things running well. Isn't that what prunes are known for? Yet nobody has ever been able to prove that fiber is the magic bullet for preventing colorectal cancer. There are important technical reasons why a definitive conclusion regarding fiber is difficult to make. Each of these reasons is related, either directly or indirectly, to the fact that dietary fiber is not a single, simple substance producing a single, simple benefit. Fiber represents hundreds of substances, and its benefits operate through an exceptionally complex series of biochemical and physiological events. Each time researchers assess the consumption of dietary fiber, they must decide which of the hundreds of fiber subfractions to measure and which methods to use. It is nearly impossible to establish a standard procedure because it is virtually impossible to know what each fiber subfraction does in the body. The uncertainty of having a standard procedure prompted us to measure fiber in more than a dozen ways in our China study. As summarized in Chapter 4, as consumption of almost all of these fiber types went up, colon and rectal cancer rates went down. But we could make no clear interpretations as to which type of fiber was especially important. Despite the uncertainties, I continue to believe that Burkett's initial hypothesis that fiber-containing diets prevent colorectal cancers is correct, and that some of this effect is due to the aggregate effect of all the fiber types. In fact, the hypothesis that dietary fiber prevents large bowel cancers has become even more convincing. In 1990, a group of researchers reviewed 60 different studies that had been done on fiber and colon cancer. They found that most of the studies supported the idea that fiber protects against colon cancer. They noted that the combined results showed that the people who consumed the most fiber had a 43% lower risk of colon cancer than the people who consumed the least fiber. Those who consumed the most vegetables had a 52% lower risk than those who consumed the least vegetables. But even in this large review of the evidence, researchers noted, the data do not permit discrimination between effects due to fiber and non-fiber effects due to vegetables. So, is fiber, all by itself, the magic bullet we've been looking for? We still, in 1990, didn't know. 2 years later, a A different group of researchers reviewed 13 studies that had compared people with and without colorectal cancer, case-control design. They found that those who had consumed the most fiber had a 47% lower risk of colorectal cancer than those who consumed the least. In fact, they found that if Americans ate an additional 13 grams of fiber a day from food sources, not as supplements, about a third of all colorectal cancer cases in the U.S. could be avoided. If you'll remember, 13 grams in real-world terms is the amount found in about a cup of any variety of beans. In recent decades, a mammoth study called the EPIC study collected data on fiber intake and colorectal cancer in 519,000 people across Europe. They found that the 20% of people who consumed the most fiber in their diet, about 34 grams per day, had a 42% lower risk of colorectal cancer than the 20% who consumed the least fiber in their diet, about 13 grams per day. It's important to note once again that, as with all of these studies, dietary fiber was obtained in food, not as supplements. So all we can say is, fiber-containing diets seem to significantly reduce the risk of colorectal cancer. We still can't say anything definitive about isolated fiber itself. This means that attempts to add isolated fiber to foods may not produce benefits, but consuming plant foods naturally high in fiber is clearly beneficial. These foods include vegetables, the non-root parts, fruits, and whole grains. In reality, we can't even be sure how much of the prevention of colorectal cancer is due to fiber-containing foods, because as people eat more of these foods, they usually consume fewer animal-based foods. In other words, are fruits, vegetables, and whole grains protective, or is meat dangerous? Or is it both? A 1985 study in South Africa helped to answer these questions. White South Africans have 17 times more large bowel cancer than black South Africans, and this was first thought to be due to the much higher consumption of dietary fiber among black South Africans provided by unrefined maize. However, black South Africans later were found to be increasingly consuming commercially refined maize meal, maize minus its fiber. They now eat even less fiber than the white South Africans. Yet colon cancer rates among blacks remain at a low level, which calls into question how much of the cancer protective effect is due to dietary fiber alone. A later study showed that the higher colon cancer rates among white South Africans could well be due to their elevated consumption of animal protein, 77 versus 25 grams per day, total fat, 115 versus 71 grams per day, and cholesterol, 408 versus 211 milligrams per day, as seen in chart 8.5. The researchers suggested that the much higher colon cancer rates among white South Africans may be more related to the quantity of animal protein and fat in their diets than their lacking the protective factor of dietary fiber. What is clear is that diets naturally high in fiber and low in animal-based foods can prevent colorectal cancer. Even in the absence of more specific details, we can still make important public health recommendations. The data clearly show that a whole foods, plant-based, WFPB diet can dramatically lower colorectal cancer rates. We don't need to know which fiber is responsible, what mechanism is involved, or even how much of the effect is independently due to fiber. Other factors. Studies done through the end of the 1990s have noted that the same risk factors that promote colorectal cancer, a diet low in fruits and vegetables and high in animal foods and refined carbohydrates, can also promote insulin resistance syndrome. From there, scientists have hypothesized that insulin resistance may be responsible for colon cancer. Insulin resistance was described in Chapter 6 as a diabetic condition. And what's good for keeping insulin resistance under control is also good for colon cancer. a diet of whole, plant-based foods. This diet happens to be very high in carbohydrates, which have recently been under assault in the marketplace. Because carbohydrate confusion persists, let me remind you that there are two different types of carbohydrates, refined and complex. Refined carbohydrates are the starches and sugars obtained from plants by mechanically stripping off their outer layers, which contain most of the